This episode of See Here, we're working in a Kremlin with a two-headed dog.
To See Here, episode number 16. Number 16! What a milestone!
Holy shit. Whoa!
How the hell did we get there?
So old.
Oh, good lord. You're listening to See Here. This is the music film discussion podcast, if it's your first time. If you're back for your 16th time, well, we're absolutely gratified that you've stuck with us this long, and we hope that you'll stick with us for another 16 episodes, and even longer if we make it past 32. My name is Morris. I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. And also on this show is Mr. Bernard Stickwell, and he's based in Bath in England. Hello, Bernie.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
And Mr. Tim Merrill, he's based in Seoul in South Korea. Good evening, Tim.
Howdy, howdy.
And we are missing Miss Wendy Freeman, who normally records from Chicago in the United States, but she's off at, I don't know, what's she doing this time? She's at a comic convention. I was going to make a crack about George Eastman, but we've done that.
It's the big Chicago C2E2 convention this weekend, I think. So, yeah, she's not going to miss that. It's like comic book heaven, so...
You're trying to tell me that's more important than chatting with her crew?
Well, obviously for me and Tim it isn't, but for Wendy, well, you know, actions speak louder than words, don't they?
Anyway, the three of us have decided that we are going to carry on and record See Here episode 16 for you. Have I mentioned that yet? And this time we are doing the very first request that we've had from a listener at the beginning of the year. I put out a note on the See Here Facebook page asking the members on the Facebook page and hopefully our listeners what films they would like to have us speak about. And we said we'd take four. So, you know, between the four of us, we get eight choices and we let the listeners have four choices. And this time around, Mr. James Curley, hope you're listening, James. This is your show. He came up with the documentary about one Mr. Rocky Erickson of the 13th Floor Elevators and other bands. And the documentary is called You're Gonna Miss Me.
I live together with my family in an old house. I have a big family. I have lots of baby brothers and sisters all over the house crying, screaming, crawling, and playing in dangerous areas. I started thinking that maybe there could be weird things that could lay dormant. So I tried to think what these things could be.
To this day, Rocky Erickson stands alone because he had the gift of that wonderful voice.
He wanted to write his music. He wanted to play his music. And that's all.
He could produce music without effort. It just poured out.
Anyone who tried to have a conversation with him understood that he was not of this world.
Well, I've gone through three changes. I thought I was a Christian, then I was with the devil, and then the third one where I know who I am. You know, I feel like I'm an alien.
He's just this mysterious figure. You know, whatever happened, he's the great lost vocalist of rock and roll.
You know, in the old days, they'd take him out and hang him. But in modern day times, send him to Rusk. Say he's crazy.
He said, if I could just stop all the damn noise that's in my head, I would be so happy.
Then I got to thinking that maybe something had happened, something that they couldn't talk about. What's happening? Oh, my God. Goodbye,
sweet dream. For the past 12 years now, he just has this little bit of human contact with his mom, and that was it.
I promised God that I would give him all my sons.
She's trying to pick whoever's going to be around Rocky.
I'm not stopping anybody. People don't have to hate me.
None of us really had a family. I've been struggling to make sure that I stay out of the nut house.
We can give him whatever medication. It is not going to make his schizophrenia go away.
Goodbye, sweet dreams.
Have a broken family that needs to get back together.
My brother should not be living in poverty. I want to give Rocky back his music.
Goodbye, sweet dream.
So we thank you, James, for making that suggestion. We've taken that on board. We've all watched it, and I believe we have plenty to speak about. So what do you reckon, guys? Should we get straight into it?
Go ahead.
Let's.
All right. Okay. So for those of you out there who are unfamiliar with the name, and I'm sure most of you are, but basically Rocky Erickson started out as the lead singer of a band called the 13th Floor Elevators in the mid-60s. And this film, it's sort of like a fly-on-the-wall account of time from the late 90s. I think 1998 is when the film, Kevin McAllister, who's the director of this film, may have started making it in 1998, but the film didn't come out until 2005. And it talks about Rocky, who is in, shall we say, and as most of the show will go on, in a fragile state of health. And the documentary tells us how he got to be in this fragile state of health and the sequence of events. And it's like one of those sorts of films where I'm sure the director went in expecting to do one type of film and ended up with something very, very different, which probably made it all the more interesting for him. But that's as we go on. So we've got plenty to talk about. This is a film about all sorts of things. Fragile mental health, musical genius.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you guys how you came about becoming familiar with Rocky Erickson.
For me, it was probably far from being an epiphany or anything like that. I can't remember which came first. It was either hearing You're Gonna Miss Me as the opening cut on the film of High Fidelity, the opening minute. You see the needle going down on the record, and we hear You're Gonna Miss Me right at the beginning of the film, just as John Cusack, just as his girlfriend is walking out on him. So it's either that or when I bought the Nuggets box set and heard that song for the first time on CD, one of that absolutely fantastic box set. Nothing, it was no great epiphany, but I remember being really knocked out by the song at the time. But that was, yeah, that was the first time I remember hearing that song and being familiar with the 13th Floor Elevators. But at the time, I didn't sort of pursue what's the story behind this band. You know, who is this Rocky Erickson fellow? It was just another great song.
Huh.
Bernie?
I was about 15 years old, and I was just coming out of my sort of teenage gothy type phase, which I'm slightly embarrassed about. But a friend of mine, he was really into kind of 60s music, and he started making me these compilation tapes. And I remember one track on there was Fire Engine by the 13th Floor Elevators, and I'd just never heard anything like it. And it's mainly because of that electric jug sound. It sounds like nothing on earth.
Right.
And I just remember being blown away by that. So I bought a copy of the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Elevators, and that was it. That was kind of my way in. And over the years, I've amassed a few other Elevators LPs, and just through reading around the subject and being a music nerd in general, just, you know, finding out about Rocky and his issues over the years, and you know, obviously, which is, you know, that are covered in this film. 15 years old, and as is often the case with music, which kind of affects you and affects your life, it's down to a friend or an older brother or somebody who's clued in and sharing the joy, you know. So
right.
That's how I got there.
Nice. Tim?
Well, back in the 80s, well, there's still, in Toronto, there's still a radio station there called Q107. And every Sunday, they used to do what they called the Psychedelic Sundays. Everyone would tune in. You'd be puttering around the house or doing whatever you do, and they'd play all kinds of stuff. And they'd get into themes and things. And they got into American psychedelia. And I remember hearing one Sunday where they were playing, like, you know, Red Crayola and Sir Douglas Quintet, and then they played The Moving Sidewalks, Billy Gibbons' original band, and then they played the 13th Floor Elevators. And like Bernie was saying, you know, about the electric jug, they played Step Inside the House, you know, that, you know, that sound was just like, holy shit, what is that? It's you know, it wasn't a theremin, but it just had this bizarre sound. It just, you know, and with Rocky's twang, his voice, it just really struck me. And then I you know, I really didn't give it much heed. And then a couple of years later, I was really into, you know, this label Enigma, and American label Enigma, and they used to put all these compilations where they'd have TSOL on there, and they'd have different bands. And then a guy I knew, John Truby, was on Enigma, and there's a bunch of people that were on there. And then Rocky Erickson, Enigma Pink Dust was the label that put out all of his albums from the 80s. But then that's where I first heard, you know, Red Temple Prayer, Two-Headed Dog, and Night of the Vampire, and
mm-hmm.
you know, his horror rock that really, you know, and then all of a sudden in the mid 80s, I see the movie Return of the Living Dead. And then they use his song, Burn the Flames.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of, one part of the film.
That's a great scene,
oh,
isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Use that music. It's perfectly amazing. Yeah.
Because it's not a spoiler, because everybody must have seen the film by now, but there's a guy who turns into a zombie, and instead of, you know, kind of giving in to eating flesh, what he decides to do is climb into a crematorium. So he lays himself down, and he hits the button, and you see him go in, and then it's guy Rocky singing, you know, burn the flames, higher, 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 and higher. You know, it's amazing. It's just really cool. So burn.
So burn. Burn the flames. Higher, 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 and higher.
But there's all, you know, this guy has been... So I wouldn't say prolific, but Rocky has had more kind of different, I guess you could put him on a parallel with Bob Dylan, in a sense that Dylan went through his kind of, I wouldn't call them characters, but his kind of, you know, phases, if you know what I mean. And Rocky's right. The same way. There's the 60s Rocky, and then there's the, you know, post-hospital Rocky, and then there was like the horror science fiction Rocky, and now you've got the modern Rocky, you know, with his new band. So, well, I mean, he's gone.
I was going to say, notwithstanding the modern Rocky, I would have said that sounds more like Elvis. So, you know, the post-hospital, replace post-hospital with post-military. And then you've got, you know, pre-army Elvis, post-army film Elvis, post-60s Las Vegas, sure. Elvis. So, yeah, another one with multi-phasing.
And before we go on with... the film, the one thing I want to make a confession too, and this might seem like sacrilege to a lot of people, but I'll take Rocky over Bob Dylan any day.
Look, there's a lot of people who say, I'll take so-and-so over Bob Dylan. I think Bob Dylan's, you know, becoming something of a scratching post. I don't think that's fair.
Well, I like Dylan, and I'm not trying to take the piss with Dylan, but what I'm saying is it's just like, there's a lot of times where Dylan, you know, everyone said his lyrics were so profound and that, you know, he was right on the pulse of what was going on and blah, 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 blah. But I find it a lot of kind of, you know, a lot of toss. But then with Rocky, everybody just thinks, you know, they're kind of, you know, like loony lyrics, you know, or the kind of ravings of a madman. But I think he's written some of the most beautiful songs. And Goodnight, Sweet Dream, I love that song. You know, it just kills me. And I mean, like this guy, when he is on point, I mean, he just can't be touched, you know? And even the songs like he wrote, like, you know, Two-Headed Dog, Night of the Vampire, all of his stuff, there's not a bad song that I've heard that he's written. You know, there's nothing that I've... Even when he was completely unhinged, there was a sincerity to him. And I mean, yeah, there's a lot of people that might want to throw him in the same boat as Daniel Johnson or Wesley Willis, that kind of thing, right? But he's not. I think with Rocky, he's an entity unto himself, and I think that there's a real honest-to-God sincerity in what he's singing about. When he's singing about, you know, the night of the vampire and don't go out, you know, and, you know, there, you know, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be bled dry, he really means it. Mm. He's not just writing, you know, he's not a Screaming Jay, like, you know, shtick kind of guy. I love Screaming Jay too, but it's just not, I don't know how to put it. It's just Rocky is
but the difference
sincere.
The difference between Rocky and someone like Screaming Jay is what Screaming Jay did was knowing shtick, whereas, you know, Rocky really thought, or at least, you know, claims in the movie that he really thought that the aliens were out to get him, and so that reflected a lot of those sorts of song lyrics as well. So
sure.
It was never shtick.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the word sincerity, Tim, because it's, you know, he may be singing about vampires or aliens, but the emotional content is absolutely there. And as you say, he believes it and that emotion comes through. And I will take feeling and emotion over, you know, sort of artifice and intelligence or, you know, clever lyric writing any day of the week. Sure. Feeling over technique every time, as far as I'm concerned. So,
Tim, I'll put this.
He's got it in spades. So
I was going to say, Tim, I don't know, not necessarily much from a lyrical perspective. And actually, probably in the light of what you guys have just said, certainly not from a lyrical perspective, because this guy is prone to write, inverted commas, clever words. But musically, like you, Bernie, I've got the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, and that sounds to me a lot like Arthur Lee in Love. Tell me, is that crazy, or can you see a similarity there musically? There's something about sure. that reminds me of Love.
I think it was just something that was in the air at the time, wasn't it? That if you were a possibly. Young man in a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, it was, got to say as well, my God, Rocky's voice on those early Elevator recordings. Well, he actually, you know, right the way through, but that scream on You're Gonna Miss Me. I mean, tell me he isn't one of the greatest rock vocalists of all time. That is just unbelievable.
And it's so funny because in the film, you know, he attributes the big influence to James Brown.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can see that with the scream, that wow, you know, like, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
You know, you can see it. But, you know, what's really funny is that, you know, like, for example, one of the more popular Elevator songs was, you know, Baby Blue, which Dylan wrote, and then Van Morrison and them covered. But I've always said that, as far as I'm concerned, the Elevators, that's to me is, you know, that's the definitive cover of the song. Like, that's it.
Except for the interest in, however, the last 15, 20 years or so, that he otherwise might have ended up, I don't know, would he have ended up as a footnote? Is that only, they didn't necessarily attain the same level of interest. There wasn't like, you know, a big 13th Floor Elevators revival, like there was a Doors revival in the 80s or some right. such thing.
You could maybe put, again, this is a bit of a lofty statement, but you could maybe put them in the same boat as the Velvet Underground in that famous quote that I think Frank Black said, that, you know, they might not have been super successful, but anybody who heard them was inspired by them.
Oh, sure. So
and, absolutely.
Went out and started a
band. And, you know,
so I'm sure that they were a lot more influential than, you know, the mass media or, you know, the accepted historical perspective on these things. You know,
sure.
Was actually the case. So,
right.
I was going to say, it's kind of an interesting parallel too. Like, you know, in the film, you know, not to jump ahead, but there's a bit where, you know, they've got Rocky, you know, with the Elevators. I mean, well, Rocky with his band opening up for the Butthole Surfers, right? And I see the 13th Floor Elevators kind of being on parallel with the Butthole Surfers in the sense that, you know, back in the 60s, the Elevators were just, you know, going as far as they could go and being as intense as they could, you know, and just barely hanging on the rails and just, you know, like blasting off into the sun, where everybody else was like, holy shit, man. Like, you know, these guys are insane. Like, they went the furthest out there. They're nuts, you know. And then everybody in the 80s, when the Surfers came around and then they were doing their live shows where, you know, everybody was on LSD and there was all these crazy light shows and visuals and it was just a big mess, but they were playing, you know, proficiently. Like they were just hanging on the rails and swinging off the rafters, but they were doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real parallel between these two bands because it's like, yeah, there's casualties, you know? It's like, you know, the candle that burns at both ends can only burn so long and, you know, it catches up with you and it does, you know?
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the film itself. In a nutshell, you know, okay, so we know that Rocky was the amazing lead singer for the Elevators and for other subsequent bands later on. I can't remember if this is mentioned in the film or just in something that I read on the net. Apparently, Janis Joplin turned down the offer to actually sing for the Elevators. So, you know, their jug player, right. Tommy Hall, and this was absolutely amazing because you guys sort of, you know, said you'd had that, whoa, throwback effect when you actually heard that electric jug sound. And I'd heard that album for years, that first album, but I didn't know what the sound was. And watching this film for the first time, I think, what's he doing? Oh, he's blowing into a jug. That's absolutely incredible. And he just had that rhythm down pat, and it was just absolutely amazing. We see a bit of that footage. The film does focus more on Rocky's story rather than the Elevators or any particular band or any of his musical development. I mean, the music's obviously right. part of that story, but it's really more what happened to him, how he went from moderately successful with this one big hit single to this guy who comes into his mother's apartment or his own apartment with his mother earlier on in the film and is looking through all the junk mail. We see the what's happened here before they sort of go back and fill in some of the details. So we see that Tommy Hall, the jug player, had introduced the rest of the band to LSD, and Rocky actually liked it quite a lot. And in 1968, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and is sent in and out of hospital institutions and is given electroshock therapy along the way. He declares for a while at one part of the film that he's an alien. He records albums while in one of the hospitals, or he plays in a band while he's in, I think it was in Rusk, and in that band, there were two murderers and a rapist.
And Rocky was there for possession of marijuana.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
We get these glimpses to his past, not always cohesively, but enough to put a picture together of his history. The real focus here is when he's living in the care of his mother, and he's like 50 years old when the film was being made, and his mother is not allowing him to have access to his medication that he so obviously needs, suspicious of the mistreatment that he's been handed out by medical professionals over the years. And we'll certainly come back to this whole mother versus Rocky's brothers side of the story, because I know that we've got a lot to say about that. But the question I wanted to put to you guys was that, irrespective of Rocky's story and the actual circumstances behind what went on in his life, how do you think that this documentary actually works as a film? Did Kevin McAllister actually convey the story well? Or actually, I should also say, probably credit should be given to the editor, Victor Livingston, who also made another film that I know that, Bernie, you're going to bring up in a little while. I'm not going to steal your thunder. Another great doco. But I really think that, especially in a film like this, this is as much the editor's film as it is the director's film, because I think that Kevin McAllister came in with a camera and just said, right, I'm just going to shoot whatever happens. And then it was up to Victor Livingston to assemble that into some sort of cohesive story and find an angle, which he certainly did. But I want to ask you guys, what did you think of it as a film? Did it convey Rocky's story in a cohesive way? How do you think it went?
One part of the film that I kind of, I didn't have a problem with it, but I mean, that I wish that they had done more was, I wish there had been more live footage, or I wish there had been more kind of performance of Rocky. Or I wish there had been kind of, not to present any spoilers or anything, but an addendum, to kind of what happened to Rocky, or, because, like I say, no spoilers, he winds up performing again. It would have been nice to seen some type of kind of, ending or a bookend like that. It's almost like the Sugar Man film, where you've got a guy who really made his mark at one point in time, and then he just became obsolete, or not obsolete, but obscure, I'm sorry, and he just disappeared. And then, you've got the story mainly being about what happened to him in between, and, as well as, the effect that he initially had, how that effect was felt by other people, because, I know there are so many people in Austin who, I knew friends who had actually had people that would go over and deliver groceries to Rocky and keep him stocked in cigarettes and keep him stocked in soda. And they just left him alone. And there were people that actually minded Rocky, and it was kind of they didn't sit with him, they wouldn't bother him, they would just kind of show up at the house and say, here, Rock, here's a pizza, here's a six pack of soda, here's your cigarettes, and he'd be like, oh, thanks a lot, man, and then he'd close the door and go back and live his life, so that, there's that whole aspect that I think that the film really focuses on, about the interim. But I just really wish there had been kind of, more live footage or more mention of the band, the Elevators, just there's little bits and pieces with Tommy Hall and the guys, but it's not enough to me. I don't know.
Sticky?
I like the structure of the film, the way you kind of start in the present, and as you progress through the film, it will jump back and fill in little bits of what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how Rocky got to where he is now, you know, both musically and with his family. And it does build to, there's a point where he's, they show footage of him reading a poem called I Know the Hole in the Baby's Head. Mm. And then there is, so there was something we were talking about earlier with his brother mentioned something as well. And it kind of builds to that point, I think. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of, I don't know, it's... Like I say, I like how it's structured, but at the same time, it feels a little, I don't know if manipulative is the right word, but it almost like some sort of reality TV show in that the, not that it resembles a reality TV show at all, but the editing is done in such a way as it kind of leads you in this direction. You get to this point and then it's kind of like, I don't know what I'm really trying to say here.
You know, you get to these points where there's these reality TV shows that are like interventions. You know, have you ever seen those drug intervention shows, you know, where you see in or hoarders? Hoarders, you know, where the way people are living these kind of extreme lifestyles, and they're living in, you know, in filth and squalor, and then somebody comes in and says, hey man, like, we're gonna get you out of here. Do you realize the kind of situation you're in? You know, yeah, there was a lot of the film, I think, that was kind of reminiscent of that. So I agree with you absolutely, yeah. Bernie, that in a way it was almost filmed like, you know, like you were kind of anticipating some type of, you know, change or some type of intervention on behalf of Rocky, that, you know, it's like they showed the way he was living for so long. And I have to say that there was a number of parts in this film that really, really choked me up. That hit me really, really hard. Like, for example, one moment was when, you know, Rocky's sitting in his chair before he's about to sleep. He says, you know, sometimes I just wish I was just somewhere else. Yeah, I just wish I was somewhere else, you know. And he's almost crying, like in tears.
Yeah,
and
he says, I don't like this place that much, doesn't he?
Right, yeah, that's what he said. Yeah, I don't like this place that much. Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like this place, you know. And you can see that it pains him. And the other part that really choked me up was when his brother starts seeing a therapist in order to deal with his own issues. Sumner Erickson, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there's a point where Sumner encourages Rocky to go and see his therapist. So Rocky does. And there's a point where the therapist is telling Sumner to run around the room and skip like a child, and to get Rocky to follow his brother. And they're both doing it, and they're both laughing like kids. And it's almost like you're seeing these, like, you know, middle-aged men reverting to a childhood that they never had. You're seeing them go around this room, and Rocky's laughing, and he's having the time of his life, and, you know, he's enjoying it. And it's almost like he's going back to the womb or reverting back to, you know, a younger day. At least that's what I took from it. And it was really touching to me seeing that, because it was really honest, you know, because, I mean, most people would be like, you know, you want me to run around the room? What the hell am I paying you for? You know, like, you know, you're a psychiatrist, you know, like, you're a head shrinker, you know, forget it. Yeah. But for him, he's like, yeah, I'll do that. Okay, that sounds fun, you know. And
he was already like a man-child anyway, using the modern vernacular.
So right.
The fact that he was...
Right, absolutely. Right. But there's that sincerity, in all of it, though, that you can see. Like, it's just, there's no mistaking it.
I was going to say, Bernie, because you went and brought up the... issue of, you didn't want to use the word manipulative, but you were sort of trying to indicate that maybe the film is trying to sort of point the viewer to think one way. And in my notes, I've sort of gone and written down here that one thing that impressed me about the film was that in the end, I don't think it was that judgmental.
I think you're right. It's not judgmental, but it does... That, like you say, it points you in a certain direction.
I was going to say that, okay, so from purely from a filmic perspective, this is there's no narration in this film, so they avoid that serious overtone that you'd normally get from a narrator. There's no background music which is dumbing it down for you. It's very much fly on the wall, and for all the fact that ultimately, I guess, we do sympathise more and barracking more for Sumner to get custody of Rocky over Rocky's mother, I think the film does show that Rocky's mother did care for him, and she looked after him, not necessarily in the way that Sumner would or maybe anyone else necessarily would have, but he did stay in her care at a time where she could have been just sort of kicking her feet up and doing stuff. And he was very demanding.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think what we should mention here is that Rocky's mum is obviously a damaged person.
Yes.
And Rocky's father was obviously a damaged person. And all his brothers, to a greater or lesser extent, are damaged because of their parents. And now it's not, again, this is something we were talking about earlier off the air, but because of who she is and, you know, how she thought and how she reacted to the world, maybe what she thought was best for Rocky wasn't best for Rocky. So, you know, frankly, they were a messed up family completely. And when you've got a messed up mother looking after a messed up son, it's not necessarily going to be the best thing for either of them, is it?
Right.
But I think you're right in that the filmmaker is not judgmental of the mother. I mean, just watching it, you're kind of siding more with Rocky and Sumner than you are with his mother, Evelyn. But that's because she is obviously messed up as well.
Yes.
And you look at some of the things she actually put Rocky through, as far as she was concerned. I mean, my God, that film she made about herself and her five, well, was it The Five Kings or something like that? There's an awful lot of shots of Evelyn talking about herself, lots of old sort of Super 8 footage of herself where she seems to be more interested in being filmed than having her kids filmed.
Yep.
Lots of things with her performing. She cut her own records, apparently. My God, that 13th floor elevator's Rocky Erickson Appreciation Day that seemed to be held in a local church hall where it was basically her on stage singing Rocky songs.
Right.
An awful lot of it seemed to be about her, you know, and her looking after Rocky wasn't about looking after Rocky. It was about her looking after Rocky.
You've got Sumner, though, like, he really gives his mom a nod. Because, you know, he says, he says, listen, you know, like, I've done a year with Rocky and she did so many years, so I don't know how she did it, you know, so it's just that, you know, so he doesn't,
it's great.
Yeah, he doesn't hate his mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't feel any animosity. It's just that kind of, you know, hard thing. It's a hard thing to kind of, you know, especially with family, man. I mean, it's like, you know, when you're trying to, like, for example, you get so many people who wind up, you know, being cared for by a spouse and they get elderly and then, you know, they're not taking care of their spouse, and then the spouse's family has to fight the wife or the husband for custody of their own family member. That's different, you know, that's completely different. But when this is like within the family itself, you know, that's really hard, you know, going against their mother, I mean, on the stand. It's, you know, and here's the thing too, that reading about what happened with Rocky, you know, and knowing more about it, I mean, it's briefly mentioned when Sumner goes up on the stand about why he wants to take care of his brother, but Rocky almost died from having an abscess in his mouth because all his teeth were riding out in his head, and he almost died.
She wouldn't have any medication, would she?
No, she wouldn't let him go, and he almost died.
But because of her own issues, she'd seen Rocky being mistreated at the hands of the medical staff and the Rusk and the Austin State Hospital over the years, you know, just electroshock therapy. And she probably thought, my God, that's all they know how to do is give him lots of drugs to flip him out and give him electroshock therapy to flip him out. I don't trust anyone. I don't trust any medical professional. She didn't sort of, it never occurred to her that there might be other doctors who would have his best interests at heart and look after him properly. So I mean, maybe other people who might have been in a less fragile state of mind than she was, and we've sort of already gone and agreed that the family is very dysfunctional. But because she was already fragile and she'd already seen this go on, she thought, right, that's it. I'm taking care of him. I'm looking after him my way. No one's going to put any medicine. Yoga is all he needs. And that's, whilst you think that's wrong, but you sort of, if you put yourself in her shoes, you think, right, well, I understand how you came to that conclusion.
Exactly. You can see how, that's what I mean. The film isn't judgmental about her. I mean, you can absolutely see why she would think like that, because she is who she is. It's interesting as well. Rocky's son, Jaeger, is it? He says at some point, it's not her fear of losing Rocky, it's her fear of losing control.
Mm.
And I think that speaks volumes about where her sort of head was that, you know? So, well, or is
look,
that?
But that's, I mean, look, that's his judgment, and he may or may not be true, but, or may not be right. And she wants that control, but yeah, not because she feels I need the power, but she does feel she needs him for herself to feel like she has a purpose in life, but there's no doubt that she cared for him. You know, there would be...
No, absolutely. I don't think there's any evidence that she didn't care for him. So, yeah.
Before we started recording, Bernie, you made a very good comparison to another dysfunctional family in documentary.
Yeah, it's this film reminded me very much, and you guys as well, I'm sure, of the Terry Zwigoff movie Crumb. About cartoonist Robert Crumb and his super dysfunctional family, brothers and mother. Very similar movies. Quite so much mental illness in Crumb, but...
But that was the interesting thing. You watched Crumb, and like before I went in, I sort of thought, well, this will be an interesting story about, you know, how this guy came to do his cartoons, his animation, and he seems a little bit off the planet. And then you watch it and you realise, he's the sanest one in the family.
Absolutely. Right. Frightening. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I was going to actually make a point here. Now, I think I spoke about this with Tim last week, that there's a scene early on in the film where Rocky comes back to his apartment and he turns on the TV and he turns on the radio and the stereo and the Casio keyboard all to full blast, then says he's going to take a nap. And his mother tells the camera, one of the few times where she's talking directly to the camera, she says he'll only wake up when she turns all these devices off. And this reminded me of a film that Tim introduced me to, and I'm sure a lot of the GGTMC listenership, film called Clean Shaven. And the main character in that is also a schizophrenic who mutilates himself to distract himself from the sounds in his head. Everything that he hears is white noise. Now, I don't know whether Rocky's hearing white noise in his head, but it sounds to me, he's not mutilating himself, but it's possible that he's putting on all these things at once to drown out whatever it is in his head that's torturing him. And he's not cutting himself, but he's putting all these other things on in the world. It just sort of came to mind of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I can see that. It made me think of, I remember reading an interview with Bob Mould, Muscadoo.
Yeah.
Obviously not schizophrenic, but apparently he developed really bad tinnitus. The only way he could sleep was turning the TV set up full and just getting the kind of white noise, static noise, that would actually drain out the tinnitus and let him get to sleep.
Holy moly.
So, yeah, that's pretty grim. But, yeah.
Is that why his band is one of the loudest in the world?
Well, they were. I don't know if they're... that's why he has the tinnitus.
Sugar was ridiculous. They were ridiculously loud, but... But no, the one thing I was going to say was that, you know, as we've reiterated again and again and again, that the family has gone through a huge amount of damage, and Rocky's been damaged as well as his brothers, as well as his mother. And there's, I'm trying to really, correct me if I'm wrong, Bernie, but I think there's a point at the end, near the end of the film, where one of his brothers said Rocky chose to be crazy. Rocky,
I don't think it was his brother. Was it the therapist, maybe? Or maybe it might have been one of his ex-wives, something like that.
Yeah, somebody said that was his way out.
Yeah.
That was his way out. So, I mean, like...
Coping, yeah.
Right. And, you know, and like when Tommy Hall introduces, you know, LSD to the elevators, and then, you know, you got the drummer there saying that, you know, he fell right off his stool and the guy was flipping out like during a show and didn't even know where his head was at, and Rocky's eating this stuff like Pez.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, like, you know, and you can almost kind of make a parallel to someone like Sid Barrett, you know?
Yeah, no, I've thought that more than once, yeah.
Right, right. But it really makes you wonder whether, you know, Rocky had even at an early age had just tried to kind of get out of his own mind, or kind of, you know, just vacate his own mind. I mean, you know, it really makes you wonder.
I think you're kind of gently nudging towards the sort of subject we were talking about earlier with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'll go ahead and say one of his brothers. I mean, nothing is, you know, specifically mentioned, but one of his brothers intimates that their father may possibly sexually abused the brothers, and nothing more is said of that, and that they don't sort of pursue that, and it's almost a throwaway comment.
Right, and there's nothing that comes out and explicitly says this in the film.
Absolutely.
To be fair, I mean, there's nothing. You can see that in interviewing not just Sumner, Rocky's two other brothers, all of them are messed up.
Well, Donner has been a long-term alcoholic, tried to kill himself, I believe, as
well. Kill himself, right.
Sumner had been to, like, 10 years of intense therapy.
Right.
And Rocky, as you say, Rocky chose, or some, you know, whether you choose to go crazy or not, I don't know whether that's even possible, but it would kind of make sense in the situation that he was in, anything to avoid, you know, the reality of what he was having to deal with as part of that family. I mean, again, I should reiterate what you said, Tim. This is all intimated. There isn't any evidence of this, and certainly the film doesn't make a case for it one way or another, but it's an interesting part of the story.
When you sit down and watch the film, there are things that kind of, you know, send up a lot of red flags. Yeah. If you're really paying attention to it.
And as I said earlier, you know, even if there wasn't sexual abuse, there was mental abuse and there was, I don't know, physical abuse of some kind. And, you know, that is just as damaging and you're just as, you know. So, yeah, sorry, Morris, you were about to say something then.
Yeah, no worries. I was going to say that one thing that I like about the way the film presents a lot of these issues, I mean, there are a lot of documentaries that say, right, within this 1.5 to 2 hours, we're going to tell you everything you need to know about the subject's life. You know, there can be a music documentary, it can be about any particular subject under the sun, or, you know, or for that matter, a lot of biopics. And what I like about this is, yeah, there's a lot of stuff missing, but I don't think that they ever pretend to say, we're giving you the full story by necessity. We just have to give you a few interesting points and then you can go away and talk about it with your mates. And that's what I really like about how the film sort of presents his story. I think probably for me, the big problem with it as a film, not as, you know, the detail that it's giving, is that I found it a little incohesive in terms of time structure. So there was very little indication when certain phases of his life was actually being presented. You know, like they talk about his time in the Rusk Institute and his time spent in the Austin Hospital, and then they're talking about, oh, and he got out and he's playing with this band, and then he's in the 80s and he's with another band, but we don't know that it's the 80s. At least, I mean, you can sort of work it out from the footage that you see of him, and it's not the you know, the handsome figure who you see playing in You're Gonna Miss Me on television and back in 1965, 1966, but you really don't always get a feel for when things are taking place. And I'd say that is probably my main weakness with the film. I mean, not enough so much that I thought I didn't enjoy the film or that I thought it was a poorly made film. Far from it, but I think it is a fairly valid criticism. I like to know when things are taking place. And it doesn't have to necessarily be with a big 1975 thrown on the screen. There could have been some other device. But that was often a frustrating thing for me. As well, they're going backwards and forwards in time. And like, even you mentioned that trope, Bernie, that they use at the beginning of the film where we're seeing the scene, what's happening, well, now, as they're filming it in the courtroom. And then straight after the opening credit, we see Rocky go into his apartment with his mother. And I'm thinking, oh, did this happen just straight after the verdict? Or is this before the verdict? Or when is it? It's not till like later on in the film where we see what the final verdict is, whether Sumner or his mother is going to get custody of him, that we know, right, this is how they've gone. And I really like that trope. But it was sort of diluted a bit by not giving us a sense of chronology.
I can understand that. I think it does get a little muddy in places, doesn't it? So, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think that is valid.
I was going to bring up something that just kind of hit me, and I don't know if you guys felt the same way, but there's one point in the film where Rocky's older brother is sitting with his mom, and he's calling Sumner to tell him to come and talk about getting custody of Rocky.
Come here like a man. Be a man.
Right. Yeah. Come on, man. Face the music. Come on. You know, and he's got it. And he's got this patch on his eye. And right there and then, it made me think in my mind. I thought, holy shit, man, this is like a David Lynch movie.
That scene. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was like a David. Yeah. But the whole film, I mean, the way, you know, Rocky's mom and doing her yoga and, you know, like all of it, it just seems like something David Lynch would shoot.
Very Twin Peaks.
Absolutely.
David Lynch's thing has always been the kind of, you know, the absolute weirdness under the veneer of normality.
Right. So this is about the American white picket fence.
Exactly. It's as much about the American dream as Crumb is about the American dream. Yeah. Like we said earlier, it's, you know, there's probably more dysfunctional families like this out there than there are regular families out there, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, this is as valid a slice of America as anything you can think of, I think, you know?
And the thing is, because Kevin McAllister sort of had this fascination for Rocky Erickson in the 13th floor elevator, so he decided to shoot it about him. But the truth is, you know, and something like the Nuggets box set plays this out, that there were hundreds and hundreds of bands, and we're just talking America here, had regional hits, you know, one or two hits, and we never heard from again. But the fact is that if, you know, you sent out a film director to pursue all these bands, there's probably a heap of just as interesting stories. Maybe not the same story, but, you know, heaps of interesting tales. What happened afterwards? You know, not all of them decided to, well, I'm just going to go get a day job and become an accountant or
go into real estate. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what's really weird is that it's like, you know, when you look at, for example, like Question Mark and the Mysterians, you know, people like that, they were actually back together again and touring, you know, and it's just like, holy shit, man, like that's like 45 years, 50 years, or even like a band like the Sonics out now.
Yes.
They got a brand new album out. That's crazy.
It's amazing, man. It's amazing, you know?
It is a spoiler, but it's not really a spoiler because given that probably a lot of the people who are listening to this know that Rocky has been touring around the world the last, 4 or 5 years or something like that. He was in Australia, I think, back in 2011.
2012, he played Melbourne. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that much of a spoiler to say in the end, he does end up with Sumner. The judge goes and awards custody to Sumner while acknowledging that his mother had done the best possible job that she could under the circumstances. And, yeah, look, I guess I agree with you, Tim, that it would have been good to be able to see this appendix. If nothing else, I mean, we watched this on YouTube. I'm wondering if on the official DVD release, is there like a bonus? Do you know if there's a bonus what has happened since?
There isn't, actually. I've got the DVD. Let me just grab the case. There's footage from, I think, a 2007 concert.
Okay.
Oh, Rocky's Emancipation Hearing from 2007. Because as I understand it, you guys may know better than me, but I believe he's no longer with Sumner. I think he was only with Sumner for a while. And I believe he went off his meds.
Yeah.
But because of the psychiatrist or whoever whose care he was under, he was actually doing better off his meds.
Right.
Than he had been on them and previously. And I think that was around the period where he started performing and recording again. He did an LP with, was it Okkervil River?
Right.
A couple of years ago. And then, as you say, he's been touring again. So I believe
his son's been taking care of him now.
Okay.
I think, because I think his son actually has been playing with him as well.
Right. I saw some footage on YouTube of a concert that he did. I think it might have been in Germany. And he was with this band, I think they were called the Explosives or something like that. And no pun intended, but they were dynamite. They were just absolutely full of energy. And, you know, this was not a guy who was just like trying to relive his 15 minutes of glory. He showed that he truly musically had something fresh to offer. He had a great group of musicians who I don't know if they had been specifically picked for him or he just happened to hitch his star into their wagon or whatever, but they were absolutely fantastic. And this sort of makes me think in a way of another Damaged Soul and a documentary, and that was when did I see this? In the mid-2000s or something like that. The film was I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. It was the documentary about Brian Wilson. And he ended up working with Wondermint, who were already like an existing...
Yes, yeah.
Band, and a very different sort of music style, I guess, to what, you know, Rocky Erickson was doing. But the same thing, they found a group of sympathetic musicians. And didn't Arthur Lee end up with a group called Baby Lemonade?
Which I was just going to mention that, Morris. Arthur Lee and Baby Lemonade, they actually played in Bath, of all places.
Oh, right. Did you
go? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. I think that was only a couple of years before he died.
Wow.
So, that was fantastic, yeah.
So, but it just sort of went to show that, anyway, that he had still something to offer. I mean, even more so in a way, and God knows I love Brian Wilson, I love the Beach Boys, but it seems like, even though Brian has been still, you know, making albums of new material, but by and large, he's still sort of resting on his legacy, which, you know, nothing wrong because it's an incredible legacy. But it looks to me like, from what I saw on YouTube, that, you know, Rocky onward and forward, I've got something new to offer you. He's not sort of like trying to say, oh, you remember me from the 13th floor elevators. Right, well, okay, well, here's those sounds. I'm going to... No, he's going ahead and doing something new, and it sounds relevant, and it sounds like that, you know, without wanting to show my age, he's telling the young kids, this is how it's done.
We were saying earlier about the Sonics, you know, I mean, that album coming out, I've just heard it again and again and again, where it's just like, you know, everybody's saying, what the hell's wrong with the kids today that they can't keep up the beat like this? You know, these guys are 65, yeah. 70 years old. What the hell's the problem today, you know? And I mean, still Rocky's the same. I mean, Rocky is Rocky doing what he's doing, you know, and it's just...
But it is nice that Rocky himself, you know, it seems to be a happy ending.
Right.
I mean, the film itself, the ending is a little ambiguous. You feel that he's in a better place and he seems a little better.
And that's right. Okay. Because that's actually okay. I sort of think that if he'd been filming for another couple of years and he sort of came and said, look, he's on stage, and we could go away and smile. I like the fact that the film ends at the point where they say, look, he's been through hell. He's had all these awkward circumstances. And now here he is, at a stage where he has the potential to do better. You, the audience, after watching this film, keep an eye and see what happens. And we know what happens after the film, but I think, actually, I like the fact that it ends where it does. It's, well, let's see what happens. We don't need to give you the happily ever after ending. We're giving, by the fact that he's now with his brother, that's already potentially happily ever after. And I think that's a good thing. So any final thoughts?
Well, you know, I was going to say the one thing that I really love about this film is that, you know, it's really strange, but at no point in the film does Rocky ever display any kind of anger or kind of hostility or just attitude. I mean, like, he always just seems like, okay.
He's
pretty passive, whatever. Isn't he? Yeah.
Right. He, totally. And I mean, you know, it's just insane where, you know, a lot of times with musicians or artists, you know, they get, you know, they disappear up their own arse and, they wind up sniffing their own farts and just getting so wrapped up in their own trip. Where Rocky's just kind of like, for example, there's the bit where in the film when he's going to go out with the band when he's opening up for the Surfers and he's not into it. He doesn't want to do it.
Mm. He looks totally bewildered, doesn't he? That's quite painful scene to watch.
Right. And he's just like, I can't do it. I'm not into it. I just can't do it. I don't want to do it, you know? And I mean, he could have went out there and went, yeah, I'm Rocky Erickson, man. Like, I am the Lizard King. You know, like, you know, he could have gone out there and done that, but he didn't. He was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not me. It's just, you know, and you have to admire that in the man. He wasn't doing it to be an asshole. He was doing it because it just wasn't in him anymore. You know?
Yeah.
Bernie, final thoughts?
I think it's a great film. I really like it. Watch it. I haven't watched it for... I've had it for a few years, and I've not seen it since I first bought it. And it's a very good film. It's emotionally affecting, and it's worth a watch. I think everyone should check it out.
Definitely.
Yeah, completely with you on that. And it's emotionally affecting because the story itself speaks for itself. I don't think there's any...
No, it's not an emotionally manipulative... No, let me say that again. Emotionally manipulative film. Thank you. Despite what I said earlier, maybe the filmmaking itself is... Well, yeah, it's not, you know, we talked about that earlier. But yeah, it's not emotionally manipulative, and it's a hopeful story, and yeah, it's you know, it's an emotional, touching experience watching.
Well, when you first see it and you see the situation in Rocky, you think, there's no way nobody's coming back from that.
Yeah. Like, that first no scene way. Where you kind of go into his apartment. I mean, you can just smell it in there, can't you? It's,
right,
it's piled over with crap. He's got that huge, big clump dreadlock in his hair where he's obviously not washed for the last 10 years.
Right.
And it's, yeah, it's quite distressing, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that he gets, well, as you were just saying, Tim, sorry, I'm stealing your
thoughts here. No, it's all right. But it's just what really gets me about this whole thing is that, you know, like I was saying earlier about how the man just wrote some of the most beautiful songs that I've ever heard. And I mean, you know, just sheer magic. And to see him, you know, like living in squalor, or to see, you know, like just this diamond in the rough, like you say, it's distressing. And, you know, and in the end,
isn't it?
It is. It is. And then ultimately in the end, you know, to see him trying to come, you know, it kind of reminds me of that, was that film with Robin Williams and, Robert De Niro? The Awakenings?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of that where, you know, it's like this guy is kind of, you know, in this kind of, you know, fugue state for a long time. And then all of a sudden he's just able to kind of, you know, just come back to life, you know?
All right. Well, on that emotional note, I didn't think we'd ever be able to bring Robin Williams into this, but that's a very good comparison. We've come to pretty much the end of episode 16 of See Here, and I really must say that I think this is a really wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. So next month will be episode 17, and Bernie, it's your choice for next month, so hit it to us.
Suck it to you. I'm going to suck it to you.
Suck it to me. Suck it to me. I'm getting all Dan Rowan and Martin's laughing here.
So. Well, the last couple of shows, we have done documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking maybe we could do something a little different. It's a horror film. I will read you the synopsis on IMDb. Demons hypnotize the general public by posing as a rock and roll band. It is 1988's Black Roses.
Oh, nice.
I don't know this one.
I'm aware of it. I've never seen it, though. This will be a first-time watch for me as well. So hopefully we're going to have some fun with this one.
Tim's laughing evilly in the background.
Oh, nice. Is that a good or a bad laugh, Tim?
Oh, man. Well, let's just say that, you know, if it was a food, we could appreciate the fine fromage. You know, there is a an eloquent bouquet wafting from the it's a fun film.
Okay.
Do you know, I think we need a dose of that. I think we've done some serious movies, and I think
right.
Not to say that they haven't been fun, but we need some cheesy, goofy ass rock and roll action, and I think this might provide it. Yeah,
I look immensely forward to having a view of that and chatting, and hopefully our beloved Wendy will be back with us next month to discuss this film on See Here episode 17. If you've been enjoying the show, please write into us. If you haven't been enjoying the show, please write into us. But just keep listening. Let your friends know that we exist. You can find us at seehere.podbean.com, or you can look for See Here, that's SWHEAR, See Here Podcast on iTunes. You can email us at seeherepodcast@gmail.com and come up with some further suggestions, or join the Facebook group. We'd love to have your input into this little community that we have. And it is a little community, but, you know, we're always willing to chat with anyone who wants to talk about music-related film. And I think that's pretty much covered all the housekeeping stuff over there. So, Bernie, Tim, I bid you a fond farewell. It's been a wonderful
evening. Been a pleasure. Absolutely. And thanks to James for suggesting this movie. We had.
Yeah, thank you, James. That was a good call.
Thanks, James. Yes, absolutely.
Great excuse to watch it again. Yeah,
right. Thanks, James. You know, we always encourage people to please join our community, as Morris says, and, you know, give us a listen, because as they say, you know, it's only because of you that makes it big, right? So there you go.
That's right.
So we'll see you next month. And until then, please listen to a lot of music, watch a lot of great movies, and just generally be nice to each other. Okay, cheers.
Cheers. Night.
Bye.
This is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.